Welcome to another edition of the Media Twits. I'm Mark Glazer, executive editor of PBS Media Shift in San Francisco, and joining me from New York is Rafat Ali. How are you doing?
Hey, Mark. How's it going?
Good. Your startup is making some progress, I guess. This is Skift.
Yes, it is. Yeah, thanks for asking. Yes, it's been an extremely. I don't think I've worked. This hard. Well, I've not worked at all for the last 2 years that much, really. And the last week has been crazy busy as I'm raising money for it, and it's the middle of investor pitches and all that stuff. So it's a lot of fun because if nothing is launched, everything is possible.
And once you launch something, then that's your thing, and you're locked in a little bit, I guess.
Yeah, especially. I mean, there was this article, I think, in the New York Times a couple of weeks ago by Nick Bilton about how investors are saying, don't focus on revenues, because if you start having revenues, then you won't, then the acquisition may be more difficult because then they value you based on revenues.
Right.
I feel like a little bit of that on the even before that, where if you're too locked into an idea, investors get wary. They just want to sort of know that you can move fast and you sort of kind of know what you're doing.
So can you talk about what the startup, what the idea behind it is?
It's in the online travel sector. I think we've talked about, we may have talked about that on some previous shows. I'm calling it a travel intelligence media brand that I'm trying to build. And it's a multi-phased idea, and it takes some of my previous experience and applies it to the travel vertical. I hate to call it a vertical because it's the world's largest industry by GDP contribution and the world's largest by employment. So it's not a vertical per se. It's one of the world's largest industries.
Wow. Well, good luck with it, and keep us posted on your progress. We'll definitely keep following what you're doing there for sure.
Thank you.
So the headlines this week are kind of interesting. One of them was that the cable companies seem to be kind of fighting back, especially Comcast is kind of leading the charge. There's a story in GigaOM about how all the different ways that Comcast is kind of hurting people who are kind of cutting the cord, and just the ways that they've kind of fought against people who cut the cord. And one of them is they own NBC, and now when they also are part owner of Hulu, and you know, Hulu, as we talked about, now might be authenticating and saying that, you know, people will have to have a cable or satellite subscription to get Hulu for free. And now they're talking about the Olympics coming up this summer, that NBC is putting all the events, streaming everything online. I don't know exactly what that means, but everything will be available for free online, but you have to have a cable or satellite subscription. So, you know, that leaves people like us out in the cold. It just seems like one step after the next, there's just so many ways that kind of the cable, especially Comcast, is kind of fighting back against us.
Is it confirmed that they're going to restrict for people who have a subscription?
Yeah, that's
oh,
that's
wow,
what it,
that's gonna
what,
suck.
Yeah, I mean, well, obviously you can get NBC over the air and watch shows the same way that we watch anything over the air.
Well, only NBC, yeah, because they're covered across. It's very little of it is probably going to be on NBC. Most of it is going to be other channels that NBC Universal owns that are cable or
exactly
satellite.
Yeah, so it'll be a lot on cable, and then online would have been the best way for, you know, cord cutters to watch it. And you know, it seems a little odd that I mean, not odd, but it seems a little harsh to those of us who are cord cutters that we're going to miss, you know, watching all those things. Although, you know, we always figure out ways around these kinds of blocks.
Yeah, I wonder. I don't know this because I haven't subscribed to cable in a while. Can you subscribe for a month? Just to get your password. I may have to do that. I mean, really, you cannot miss the Olympics. Or I may have to, and this is, I think a lot of people who are tech savvy can do it, can what can use a proxy IP to log into BBC in UK, which I used to do quite a bit. And BBC streams has been streaming everything online for, I think, for the last two Olympics, not just, I mean, of course, this one as well, because this is their hometown.
Yeah, but I saw a lot of comments on the story about this were saying, a lot of commenters were saying things like, you know, they didn't really like NBC anyway, and they usually went around somehow and found international coverage, you know, in some way. So you'd think that there'd be a way around it online. But, you know, this is an opportunity that, in a way, NBC's missing out on having a huge, large online audience. I know that they're trying to make this a real experiment in, you know, this. It's going to be available on, you know, smartphones, tablets, you know, total multi-platform access. So, and they're going to be measuring everything as far as usage. So it'll be interesting. It'll be almost like a real test bed to see how people use it.
Yeah, and it'll be fascinating. I just I didn't know that they were restricting it to cable subscribers. It makes sense from their perspective, of course, from business perspective for Comcast, it makes sense.
Yeah. So for this podcast, we're going to go a little bit more in depth on the first story is about Yahoo CEO Scott Thompson, and what came to light is an activist shareholder. Found that he had a computer science degree listed on his biography, and in the SEC filing that Yahoo had made referring to him, saying that he had a computer science degree that he never got, and that's kind of caused a firestorm. And we'll talk to All Things D's Kara Swisher to get her take on it. She's been covering this story and on it with updates nearly every day, and there's a question as to how long he'll last as CEO. Then we'll talk to we'll talk about the future of online paid content, and we'll have the co-founder of Press Plus, what was called Journalism Online, Stephen Brill, and Tech Dirt's Mike Masnick, who both talk about paid content, what's happening with various kind of paywall and metered wall services. A couple just shut down, and you know what the future of that entails. Kara Swisher is co-executive editor of All Things D and co-producer and co-host of the D Conference, now getting ready for its 10th year coming up soon. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks a lot. Good to talk to you.
So everything that's been happening has been kind of head spinning at Yahoo. Mm-hmm. As usual, they're kind of like outdoing themselves, even from, you know, the crazy stuff they've done already.
Yeah, it's like Real Housewives in Silicon Valley. They just keep... the hits keep on coming, so to speak.
Which, you know, keeps you busy and happy, too.
Not happy, just riveted, I have to say. I don't know if everyone else is. Although we get a lot of, you know, people seem to like this story, but...
Yeah, so what happened is, just to recap for everybody, that Dan Loeb, this investor who's part of Third Point Investing, has a 6% stake in Yahoo and has been one of these kind of activist investors trying to get change at the company. And he is the one who dug up the claim by the CEO, Scott Thompson, that he had a computer science degree that never existed, but had popped up on his bio both at Yahoo and when he was at PayPal and eBay, and had never been corrected. Now Yahoo, well, he said Scott Thompson has come out and said he's sorry.
No, he didn't, actually.
Or
he
that he's sorry for the distraction.
Yes, he's not sorry for the actual act. No, not yet. Soon, right. Perhaps, but not today.
Not today. He's still busy doing other work.
Apparently.
And meanwhile, this one of the directors who had been Patty Hart, who'd been involved in the hiring and vetting, or lack of vetting, for Scott Thompson, has stepped down. And the question is, what about Scott Thompson? I mean, you have some great coverage on All Things D about he's in the middle of so many things, trying to turn around this company, laying people off, working on selling assets. Is this about timing? What do you think it is that why he's still in the job?
Well, I think they're doing the investigation. That's what I think is happening. Although, honestly, a lot of people at Yahoo would have been fired immediately for such a thing. So it's a little bit unusual that he's there hasn't been any censuring of him for the actual mistake, even if it wasn't, you know, I don't. They called it initially an inadvertent error, which just is the most lame excuse I've heard in a long time from a company. You don't make errors. Did someone by accident type computer science all of a sudden? You know what I mean? It's just like, oh, I didn't meant to type nothing in there. I typed computer science.
How did it accidentally get in there for 10 years?
Well, exactly. I mean, you know, whatever. Okay, but it's not, they shouldn't have said that initially. They should have said nothing or also just immediately apologize for the mistake. Because most people, then there have been people at Yahoo that have been fired for having a CV that was not accurate. And so he has, you know, nothing's happened yet because they're investigating how it got in there, which I'm not sure they're ever going to find unless he fesses up or if he didn't do it, someone else does. And so I think they're investigating how it got in there, how the hiring happened, how Yahoo overlooked it, even though it was correct in eBay filings, even though it was incorrect on eBay's website, which Thompson was in charge of his bio on that website, and it was correct in eBay's legal filings, which the legal people obviously vetted correctly. But the both inaccuracies got into both Yahoo's website and also in its regulatory filings, which is that's troublesome. That means they didn't do any checking. The lawyers didn't, clearly.
And now you just found out that Moira Gunn on her show, 3 years ago, had talked to Scott Thompson, and there's this exchange where she mentions she's really, you know, caught up in his degrees and talks about it, and he just goes right along with it. It's
right,
really weird.
Yeah, I wrote about that last week. Like, he had said that he didn't say he didn't have it, but he's clearly talking as if he agrees with her. She says it quite clearly. You have a degree in computer science and accounting. And she's quite riveted to that because it's an unusual combination, and she happens to have a computer science degree. And she says, that's what PayPal is. Wow, you have both degrees. And he just goes, yeah. You know what I mean? Like, and you don't quite – I mean, if you want to give him the most benefit of doubt, I'm not sure what he was saying yeah to. But he doesn't deny it. You know, he doesn't say, it's like someone saying to me, Carrie, I don't remember what my degree is. Like, Carrie, you have a degree in economics and dance theory. I'd be like, dance theory? What are you talking about?
you would think that would stick out as something like, no, that didn't happen.
What my degree is. Anyway, so I went to the, anyway, I don't care who I go to school with. But in any case, it's accurate on the journals on our website. But I don't even.
It's been vetted.
It's been vetted by myself and others. So it's just a question of how it got there, and there's a lot of instances where he had a chance to correct it many times and hasn't. So that's really another big question the board has to look into. And if he gave people that resume with it on it, why didn't he ever check it? And even if it was something he didn't see, why didn't he see it? And so it opens up a lot of questions. It seems like a small thing, but it means a lot to a lot of people at Yahoo, especially engineers, because, you know, he was definitely putting himself out as having a technical expertise that perhaps he didn't have educationally speaking, even if he had gained it, in the workplace, which is perfectly fine. That's the thing. It's perfectly fine to not have gotten a computer science degree. Mark Zuckerberg didn't, Bill Gates didn't, and they seem to be doing okay.
Yeah, and it's weird for engineers at Yahoo because he kind of put himself out as being one of them.
Yeah, I've heard a number of people that they were shocked that he didn't because he spoke to them as if he did. But you know, it's hard to remember when people say anything directly to you. But you know, if everyone has the same feeling, came across with the feeling that there was a degree, it's an unusual thing to say. I don't know how they thought that, but it's, you know, that's what's going on here.
Yeah. So let's talk about what happens. You know, there's a good chance they'll find out there was something going on here that he could be replaced. I mean, who would they turn to next? I mean, would Tim Morse be kind of the obvious interim guy? Would they go for someone totally different? I mean, they're also in the middle of changing board members, so
right.
Complicated.
There's a whole lot of that. There's the proxy fight with Dan Loeb. There is there's the new board members, some of whom have not come on yet, but they're certainly involved in this because they don't want to be, you know, They don't want to be handed like this mess when they take over in a few, whenever the annual meeting is. And so, you know, it's a very complicated situation. He's doing the restructuring. He's still putting people in a place and jobs. He just named one. I just had a scoop on naming a head of strategy. So he's still putting executives in place. And so it's a very volatile situation just in normal times. And so I don't know who's gonna take over for him. I mean, several of the executives who were involved in the hiring are also vulnerable. You know, there's someone in legal who went over this. There's someone who knows who didn't vet it. And one of the allegations the board said is looking into is if anybody knew about it before didn't say anything. Did they sweep it under the? Did they find out about it? Maybe they did do a good job, but then they didn't report it or change it or whatever. So there's all kinds. I mean, that's the worst case scenario, is if they knew about it and went ahead anyway and hired him anyway with an inaccuracy in the resume. It just shows a very shoddy vetting process. There's two parts. It shows someone who, at the very least, had turned in an incorrect resume, at the very worst, lied about it. And the second part, that this company did such a bad job at hiring this, that you did a bad job at vetting him for hiring, that what does that say about the staff who did it, the board members who involved, and stuff like that.
And so what about Loeb and what he's trying to gain? I mean, there's this whole thing about that was in Market Watch about, you know, Minkowd, where like this guy Barry Minkowd would try to dig up dirt on CEOs and find out errors in their resumes and then short the stocks. Is Loeb? I mean, what's Loeb trying to? Is he? He's not shorting this. I mean, he's got a piece of it. So it's more. This is about a power play for him.
Well, you know, he's an interesting fellow. He's incredibly smart. I mean, I have to tell you, having covered the last proxy fight with Carl Icahn, this guy knows his stuff. He's going to the right people. Every time I show up somewhere, Dan Loeb's been there. It's kind of interesting to follow him around the atmosphere. And he's been in a lot of events. He was at TED. He was at CES. You know, he just shows up at places, which he seems to be trying to – he met the patent people who were involved, you know, to find out if that was a good idea that Scott sued Facebook. And so this guy is doing his homework. I don't think this is a quick money. He's very wealthy as it is too on top of it. But I think this is a reputation thing for him, and he wants to win, for one, because all these hedge fund people are super aggressive people. And two, I think he wants to make a reputation on this, that he can turn something around, that he can do something. He's not just a smash and grabber kind of person.
Well, we'll see what happens. It'll be plenty more to follow and figure out, and chaos will continue. So tell me about, with the conference, what are you looking forward to most for the 10th anniversary?
Oh, so much. The cakes, the celebration, the gospel choir. I think the Tim Cook interview probably is the highlight. Everyone is fantastic, actually. But I think Tim Cook has never been interviewed in public in this kind of setting before. He's been at investor conferences. He pops up there, but it's certainly not the same kind of thing. And he's also nobody knows this guy, and so I think that's going to open the conference. I think Mayor Bloomberg is going to be interesting. He's always an interesting guy. I think Aaron Sorkin. I'm a huge fan. I've been watching West Wing clips for weeks now, and he's so good, like so fantastic. And you know, Mark Pincus, we got everybody. The FTC chairman, I think, is going to be interesting given the situation around Google. We got some Google execs coming. We got, we got everybody.
Great. Well, good luck with the show, and hope it all goes well.
Thanks a lot, Mark.
So now we'll talk about the future of online paid content. Recently, Google announced that it was closing its OnePass service for paid content, and the startup Ongo, which is funded by Washington Post and New York Times, closed down after 16 months. That leaves Press Plus as the major player in running metered walls or paywalls for newspapers, magazines, and other online content. Press Plus has more than 350 publishers signed up for its service, and started offering a grandfathering in for former OnePass publishers. Our guests are Stephen Brill and Mike Masnick. Steve Brill is the co-CEO of Press Plus, an R.R. Donnelly company. He formerly started Court TV, American Lawyer Magazine, and Brill's Content. His most recent book was Class Warfare, Inside the Fight to Fix America's Schools. Welcome to the show.
How are you?
Good. Our other guest is Mike Masnick, who's the founder and CEO of Floor 64, an editor of the TechDirt blog, where he's written more than 40,000 posts. Welcome to the show, Mike.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
So, Stephen, let's start with you. And, you know, give us kind of a take of what's gone on in this realm as far as online publishers starting to charge. This has been something that obviously it's a long time coming. It seems like wave after wave we keep hearing about more newspapers charging. Has there been a change in psychology now?
Well, it's total. I mean, when we started the company just about 3 years ago today, in fact, there was a debate about whether publishers should charge for their online content, which I thought was just insane. I mean, it's total suicide. Why would you give content away for free? In the history of the planet, there isn't any significant journalism operation that pays a significant number of journalists that has ever been profitable giving their content away for free. The only exception for a few years were the broadcast TV network news operations, and they were, even at their best, when they had a monopoly on 92% of the eyeballs in the United States, they were only marginally profitable. So when we started, we thought it was clear that people should do this. It's just that Gordon Krovitz and I, my partner, were probably 2 of maybe 10 people in the world who actually thought that way, and everybody else was drinking the Kool-Aid. But, you know, the internet deserves to be free. It should be free. They're going to have trillions of advertising dollars, completely ignoring the fact that if you, the basic rule of economics, which is that if you have an ever-expanding, exponentially expanding supply of something, in this case, internet pages, the amount of money you're going to get for page views is just going to keep going down, which is exactly what's happened. But, 3 years ago, the debate was, should people do it? By last year, the debate was, how soon should I do it? I kind of know I'm going to have to do it. And this year, really the only conversations we have are, how do I do it? How soon can I do it? So we, a year ago today, we had 22 affiliates launched. Today, we're at, I think, 362. We launched another 5 today. And we have about 300 more sort of on deck about to launch. And probably by the end of the year, we'll probably have 1,000. So whoever doesn't do it, including Rafit's old company, I think they're the ones who have explaining to do. I mean, imagine a company called Paid Content that gives its stuff away for free. That's sort of like Saturday Night Live.
Do you want to say something about that, Rafit?
We were just covering, we've been covering this. I have been covering this for 10 years. Paid Content is coming up on its 10th anniversary next month. I think our view has always been, my view has always been, that the answer, as always, is somewhere in the middle, in everything in life, really. And in this case, is also the same. I think there are multiple revenue streams, multiple ways to slice and dice content.
No, exactly. And our answer is the middle, because the only thing we launch are meters, which allow a large number of people to continue getting the content for free, but ask the people who are the heaviest users of the brand to pay something for it. So the breakthrough we had was convincing people that this is the middle road, and the middle road is the most traditional, old-fashioned model of publishing, which is you get ad revenue and you get circulation revenue.
Mike, do you want to talk about the metered model? What's your take on that? I know you participated in a debate 3 years ago with David Carr on the subject about, paying or not paying, and, there's obviously a lot in between, and you guys have experimented with different things. What's your take on the metered model, where you get a certain amount of stories free, and then you kind of hit a wall after a while?
Yeah, I think I'm going to disagree pretty strongly with Stephen's position on that, in that, I think that it can work in some cases, in some uses, but I think that it tends not to be a particularly good long-term solution for a variety of reasons. And one of those is that even if you set it up in a way that, that gives people a fair amount of content for free, you're increasing just in general the mental cost in terms of, you know, how much am I going to be able to read this site, as well as how much people will be willing to share that content. And I actually think that that's an important point that, that kind of gets lost in all of this, which is that, you know, and I certainly understand where Stephen is coming from in that, you know, if you're looking at this purely as a traditional publisher, then perhaps that makes sense, where you are sort of a broadcast medium where you are sending out your content to people and that's it. But what the internet is good at isn't so much broadcast medium, though that's part of it, but really about building communities, being able to do things with communities, which include discussion and sharing of content and being a part of the story in some way or another. And when you put up those kinds of meters, you're really hindering that. And in many ways, you're taking away the value of that content because you're limiting what people can do with it. And when you take away value, I think you're actually limiting your ability to monetize.
Well, I guess the advantage I have is I'm not having a hypothetical debate here. I'm talking about, you know, data now from 350 publishers that says two very important things. One is they haven't lost a penny of advertising revenue. Not one of them who's launched this has lost a nickel of advertising revenue. Actually, three things. Two, they haven't lost any voice in their community because their number of unique visitors per month has gone down maybe 2%, maybe 4%. And three, they've started to gain significant circulation revenue online, and at the same time, they have stabilized their print franchises by eliminating the completely free alternative. So having, you know, hypothetical debates about will this work or won't it work, I mean, we are over that. I mean, you know, I can give you 350 names of publishers who will tell you that it works, and not a one who's launched us has said, you know what, this didn't work, I'm going to stop doing it.
So, well, it depends.
You know, this is not a religious debate. It's not a debate about principle. It's a debate about practicality. It works.
It depends on how you define works, and it depends on what you're talking about, right? I mean, you just said that they're going down a few percentage points. Even if you consider that limited, what you're really doing is you're preserving, you know, and I recognize for newspaper publications, you're trying to preserve their circulation revenue, right?
Well, publications, online-only sites, not just newspapers. No.
I just wrote a book,
okay? And my book sold, you know, my book did very well. It was on Times bestsellers for a little while, then the second tier list. And it would have done infinitely better in terms of readership if Simon & Schuster had decided to give it away for free on street corners. That's not my definition of a sustainable journalism model.
That suggests that the only business model is giving something away for free. Nobody has ever said that the business model is giving something away for free. What people have said is giving away something for free and then doing other things around that.
Like what? Like selling advertising, which doesn't work.
Let's talk about things that are working. Mike, you've got a community of people who are coming to your site. You're not charging them directly for content, but you've also come up with some kind of experimental ways to get them to pay for things. And I know a lot of publishers are looking at memberships, you know, things like wine clubs, niche content that they might package content archives. I mean, it seems like there's a lot more than just paying for the content.
Yeah, and you know, and here I'll actually say that, you know, probably I think in reality Stephen and I agree on this. It's just that we sort of frame it in a different discussion, which is that looking for ways to get people to pay makes sense. It's just we disagree over what it is that they're really paying for. And so, you know, a lot of what you know we've tried to do is to come up with valuable reasons for people to pay that aren't about locking up the content, because we think that the content itself is something that is out there and can be shared that actually makes the rest of what we do more valuable. So we get lots of people who are willing to pay for other things, and that can include, you know, early access to certain stories. It, you know, includes additional, you know, physical products, like, you know, we've offered T-shirts along with access. We've offered other things.
Yours a profitable operation?
It's an exceptionally profitable operation, yes. Good. And it has been for many years. So, you know, and part of that is advertising. So, you know, your claim that advertising doesn't work, well, I can say that's ridiculous. I mean, it works for plenty of people if you do it right. I think if you treat advertising if you treat your content as sort of a commodity, sort of a low cost commodity, then maybe it doesn't work. But if you can show that your content is premium content that gets premium advertisers, then that works. And if you can reach out and connect with the community and give them a reason to buy, that doesn't mean locking up the content, but often in fact encourages the resharing of the content. We actually make it pretty clear that anyone is free to take our content and do what they want with it, and other people do that. People are willing to support you in all sorts of interesting ways. So, you know, I don't think that you know, the claims that advertising doesn't work, I don't think that's true, you know, or that these other business models or that giving away content free is necessarily an insane idea or a crazy idea. You know, I think if you bundle it right and you recognize that giving away that content increases community, allows them to do more, and increases value, you then just have to figure out where do you put the mechanism to capture that value.
Well, I agree with that. But let's take, for example, where I'm coming from on this is I always found, and when I started out in publishing, I always was, you know, the editor and publisher of the stuff I ran, and we gave nothing away for free, even though, you know, the American Lawyer was a business publication, and, you know, half to two-thirds of business publications, you know, were free, you know, they were controlled circulation. And I always thought, and I still think, that if your only source of revenue is advertising, and if your source of revenue isn't your content, then you tend to value the content less, and therefore you tend to value the journalist less. I started this business for a very simple reason. I was I've been teaching a seminar for 10 years at Yale, and it's a hard-to-get-into program that we established. And one day I got a call from the mother of one of the kids who'd just gotten into the program, and she demanded to know why I was luring her daughter into a dead-end profession when she had just spent the summer interning at an investment bank, and how was she ever going to pay off her student loans. And she was right, because, you know, this was in 2009, and the New York Times looked like it was in terrible shape, and every other newspaper did, for a whole variety of reasons. But to me, the core reason was that they were heading down a path where they were that if this young woman was going to be hired, she was likely to end up being hired at a place that was going to give her stuff away for free. And that's not a way for her to pay the rent or pay off her student loans.
We give away our content for free, and we pay plenty of salaries.
Well, God bless you, I'm taking, you know, the New York Times as one example, but I can take, sure, you know, our typical sort of small town newspaper where the reporters cover the zoning board and the school district and city hall, and they write about, you know, local cultural events and stuff like that. Those newspapers have a very important place in their communities and in our democracy. And
can I jump in one second?
I think we can all agree on is that they have hit a total wall in terms of their business model, because they've been giving their stuff away for free, and we are starting to turn that around.
I don't think it's because they've been giving their stuff away for free. I think what's happened is that, you know, the market has changed in a lot of ways that has caused a serious impact, and a large part of that is things like, you know, their classified ad revenue has gone away because of Craigslist and other services.
Yeah.
But the question is, can you really bring back that same level of revenue through online subscriptions? You're claiming that's true. I'm not sure that that's necessarily, it may be true in the short term, and it may be true in some cases, but I don't think it's that large. I mean,
I don't think you get to the same level of revenue.
Okay, so then, you know, this is a time when there are all sorts of opportunities to actually expand revenue and do more things. I don't understand, you know, I can see how this might keep some paper subscribers around for a little longer, but that's it. So maybe you're delaying the inevitable for a short period of time, but I don't think
transition them into digital subscribers by getting them to sign up for both in the bundle. you transition them to digital subscribers.
But I don't think that the digital subscribers are a long-term solution, because what happens is you've just opened up an opportunity for someone else to come along and offer as good or better content. Or better content for free with a better business model.
I have a specific question on the mechanics of it, and assuming that we all agree that there are multiple ways to monetize content. Three approaches that I'm seeing in the market that Steve and Mike, both of you, are probably seeing in the market as well. One is that in a local newspaper or local publisher case, restricted to the people who are inside the community, and ask them to pay for it as part of their print subscription or online subscription. Another is free for local and paid for people outside the local area. The third is sort of what the New York Times is trying, which is X number of articles free a week or a month, and then after that you have to pay. Out of all of those three, which do you think is working the best,
We know the wall doesn't work. We know having a wall, i.e. not a meter, just making people pay from the first. We know that doesn't work because that does kill the website. It kills the voice in the community. It kills the advertising. It kills everything. You actually get more sign-ups if you use a meter. We know the Times system has worked. We know it works, you know, for all of our publishers. And we also do the geo-targeting piece that you're talking about. We have several newspapers who are not in the United States who charge for people who log on more than, let's say, five times a month from outside their country. There are all kinds of varieties of things we can do. It's actually become a little source of revenue for college newspapers. Obviously, the purpose of a college newspaper is to inform, you know, the college community. And, you know, they obviously don't want to be charging students at college for that. But if you have a group of alums and parents who are very interested in what's going on at the school, you can ask them to pay a small subscription fee if they log on, let's say, more than 10 times a month. Or you can ask them to make a donation if they log on more than 10 times a month. We have some colleges that are doing one and some are doing the other. But and they've all worked to varying degrees.
Steve, what's your take on what happened with Google OnePass? Because it sounds like they had 300 plus publishers signed up, and they were doing pretty well.
We never heard of it. We used to say to ourselves, I thought we had, a great advantage. It was actually the advantage I had starting the American Lawyer was that my competition was the American Bar Association, which everybody thought was gigantic, which they are, and terribly devoted to publishing, which they weren't. So the only thing better than having a monopoly is looking like you have a really tough competitor that isn't really in the game. I think Google never really tried hard to do this. They never understood publishers. They never understood that the fundamental thing you had to be able to offer them was the ability to bundle a print and digital subscription, which we understood from the start. But I don't think they ever really tried terribly hard to do this, much as I'd like to say, they poured all kinds of resources into it and we killed them. But we probably, if we've had 800 conversations with publishers in the last 2 years, OnePass probably came up, two or three or four times in the conversation. So they were just never a factor. I mean, we love the fact that they were out there because it prevented another startup from being able to raise money actually to compete with us.
And that was Ongo. What happened with them?
I think Ongo, I think that Don Graham and Gannett and the Times basically did that because that's when Rupert was talking about Project Alicia, which was the same thing. And I think those guys felt, well, if Rupert's doing this, this really must be a great idea. I never thought it would work because, we have enough trouble getting publishers just to act on their own, but to get them to agree to some kind of an aggregated model. I mean, that's, as well as I, that has sort of never worked, whether it's been, agreeing to selling advertising jointly, selling classified advertising jointly, but selling their content jointly, we just never thought it was a factor.
It's always been tried. Every 2 years it comes up, let's publishers should band together, or cable companies should start selling advertising together, and look where Canoe Ventures went. And every yes, 2 years.
That
it
is
comes
the
up
one job.
Happens.
If some headhunter calls you and says, "Gee, there's this really great job out there," that is the one job you never want to take, is working for one of those things.
Good point. Well, thanks, guys. I really appreciate you joining us.
Sure enough, happy to do it.
Okay, take care.
Bye bye.
Thanks, Mike.
Thanks.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of the Media Twits. I'm Mark Glazer, executive editor of PBS Media Shift, along with my co-host Rafat Ali. We want to thank our guests, Kara Swisher, Stephen Brill, and Mike Masnick, as well as PBS and the Knight Foundation for making this podcast possible. Don't forget to keep up on all the polls, news, and events over at PBS Media Shift at pbs.org/mediashift and our sister site, Idealab, at pbs.org/idealab and our new site, Collaboration Central, at collaborationcentral.org. We'll catch you next week.